from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Abortion was before the Supreme Court this week, and on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello and law professor Teresa Collette discuss the oral arguments in the case against the Texas law regulating medical standards at abortion clinics in Texas. Also, Jeanette gets insights into the creation of the new movie, The Young Messiah, with the film's director, Cyrus Narasta. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Professor Teresa Collette, is a nationally sought-after scholar and speaker on the topics of marriage, religion, and bioethics. She is an elected member of the American Law Institute and has testified before committees of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, as well as before legislative committees in several states. In 2009, Pope Benedict XVI appointed her to a 5-year term on the Pontifical Council for the Family.
Teresa, thank you so much for being with us on Register Radio today. We are talking about a very historic case, a case that was before the Supreme Court on March 2nd. This case was the first abortion case to be before the Supreme Court in 9 years, almost a decade. And because you were there, I just wanted to hear what you saw. What were the optics of that day?
Well, what's interesting is, in order to actually sit in the courtroom when these arguments occur, people will line up as early as the night before if you're not a lawyer. If you're a lawyer licensed to practice in front of the Supreme Court, there are a set number of seats set aside, and so you don't have to get there quite as early, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
but when people were arriving at 6 a.m. this morning, there was a large group of pro-life young people who were there praying and singing worship music on the sidewalk before the U.S. Supreme Court to try to bring the wisdom of God to this case. And so that was really interesting and very moving because these young people had gotten up very early to be there and showed their commitment in that way. As the day progressed, of course, people on the other side showed up, and so by the end of the oral argument, when we were leaving the courthouse, when we were leaving the Supreme Court building itself, there was a large crowd in front of the steps of the Supreme Court, and I would say probably 50% were predominantly older women who were carrying various signs that you see at the National March for Life. Mm-hmm. Keep your rosaries off my ovaries, you know,
sure.
Those sorts of signs. Abortion on demand without regret. And then you, 50% were these young people who, had large banners that said, "We are the pro-life generation." And it was really striking, the difference between the two groups.
Thank you for giving us that optic, because I think it's very important just to keep in mind what is at play here. And I think we'll continue to talk about what is at play in describing what was before the court today. What was the case? That, you know, the technical name is Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. But what does that mean? What was before? What was at stake today?
Well, the Texas legislature, some of your listeners may remember the Wendy Davis matter, the lady in the pink tennis shoes that filibustered a bill down in Texas about abortion and got national coverage. The New York Times was all over the country. Well, Texas persevered because they believed that women's health were not fully protected in the abortion clinics. And so they persevered and ultimately passed a bill that has two requirements. First, a physician who is performing an abortion in the state of Texas must have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles from where the abortion is taking place. And then second, the clinics themselves must meet the standards of an ambulatory surgical center. There's been a lot of litigation over this law. In fact, this is the third case about this law, which actually was one of the issues that the justices were concerned about. But the abortion clinics in the state of Texas have tried 3 times to have this law declared unconstitutional. And at the trial court level in this case, the district court ruled in their favor, but when it went up to the Fifth Circuit, the judges on that court said that, a couple of things. Number one, that you don't get 3 bites at the apple.
Mm.
You know, we've already seen this case. We've already ruled in this matter. You don't get to attack the statute repeatedly. There has to be closure at some point. And then secondarily, it's clear that there was a legitimate health concern on the part of the state of Texas. And once that's established, where you have competing views about the efficacy of these particular protections among the medical community, the state is free to decide which opinion that they give greater weight to. And in this case, they took the opinions of those who said that women will benefit from the doctors having admitting privileges and the clinics operating as ambulatory surgical centers. So we're done. Mm-hmm. Planned Parenthood, of course, took petitioned the Supreme Court to review the case. New York Times ran articles imploring the court to take the case, so they did take the case.
Sure.
And then
and here we are.
We are today.
So today, March 2nd, is when the case was. What was the arguments like? I mean, what are the highlights of the individual arguments?
Well, what was interesting is that the lawyer for the abortion clinic, Stephanie Toady from the Center for Reproductive Rights, the very first question she received, which was from Justice Ginsburg, who is no favorite of the no fan of the pro-life movement, Justice
right.
Ginsburg said, you know, asked her basically, what about this question of issue preclusion? What about the fact that you've sued on these admitting privileges or somebody sued on them, you know, repeatedly? Should this case really be here? And Ms. Toady said, well, we weren't sure that it would actually result in, you know, clinic closures at the time, and now we've got evidence that it has resulted in clinic closures, and so it's a different type of case now. Well, immediately, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito picked up on that and said, well, now, wait a minute. Yes, there have been clinics that closed, but have you proven that the closures were due to these laws, or were they due to other things? Aging doctors who no longer wanted to practice, just the sheer economics of the practice, mm-hmm. et cetera. And have you proven that? And there was some back and forth about that. And at the end of the day, the answer is, well, no, we are asking you to infer from the fact that the clinics closed when the law was passed and put into effect, so we should get the benefit of the doubt. But that's not the way litigation works. It's the plaintiff who has to prove that there is a causation here. And the record's pretty barren on that. And so there was a lot of conversation about that. The other interesting thing that Justice Kennedy brought up was because the abortion clinics claim not only that the law caused these closures without having proven it at the trial court level, they also claim that, and there simply will not be enough abortion clinics and physicians to perform abortions in those clinics under the new statutory scheme. And Justice Kennedy referred to this as the capacity question. What is the capacity of the existing abortion clinics to absorb those patients from the clinics that closed? And again, the answer is, well, that evidence just isn't in the record. There's an assumption because of the number of clinics that have closed that the existing clinics and the new clinics that are opening, which the Solicitor General of Texas brought to the argument, that they simply cannot absorb that. And there was a pretty healthy debate between the justices in the form of leading questions to the lawyers about whether that's actually so clear, especially when they didn't put evidence in. So the argument basically comes down to these clinics closed at the same time the law was passed, therefore you should assume that it's because of that, and because these clinics are closed, and because women therefore will not have quick and local access to abortion, that constitutes what's called an undue burden or a substantial mm-hmm. obstacle to their right to choose abortion. And that's the standard that comes from Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The Attorney General on the other side is saying, once it's decided that this law was for a legitimate state interest to advance women's health, which is uncontested at the appellate level, once that has been established, then it's up to the legislature to best decide how to advance that interest. And when you have divided medical opinion, then the legislature is free to pick whichever side of that medical opinion they choose to, and this law therefore should be upheld on that basis.
I'm speaking to Teresa Collette, and we are talking about the Texas abortion case, which was heard before the Supreme Court. Teresa, who is a law professor at University of St. Thomas, was there in the court on March 2nd during these oral arguments. Teresa, there's been so much made of the court being divided, 4-4, especially without Justice Scalia. Does today give any indication of where the court may lead? And we don't have very much time, but I do need to answer that question.
Every justice but Justice Thomas asked the question, and they were pretty indicative of where they're leaning, at least except for Justice Kennedy. It's clear that Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, Justice Ginsburg, and Justice Breyer all believe that this sort of law should not be upheld. It's equally clear that Justice Alito, Justice Roberts have some real reservations about the way the case even got to the court to start with, and whether or not the plaintiffs have proven their case at the trial court level. Justice Thomas didn't ask any questions, and Justice Kennedy was asking sort of procedural questions about, you know, should we send this back to the trial court and let them try again, which is sort of contradictory with the first question of Justice Ginsburg about, you know, you've already had the opportunity to litigate this. So it'll be an interesting question. Of course, if the court splits 4-4, then that means if Justice Kennedy votes with Roberts, Thomas, and Scalia, that the Fifth Circuit ruling will remain intact, and so the Texas law will continue to be in effect. But there are other cases in the pipeline as we speak.
Right.
Louisiana went to the Fifth Circuit. That case is already, there's already documents before the Supreme Court asking the Supreme Court to get involved. Wisconsin, the Seventh Circuit opinion there'll be a cert petition in that case. And then you've got the Mississippi case where the court is holding a cert petition prior to today's hearing to decide whether or not they even need to hear it based on how this hearing went. So even if all we get is a very technical procedural ruling in this case that upholds the right of Texas to have these laws, the court will have multiple opportunities to look at the merits of this case after they fill Justice Scalia's chair.
Well, Teresa, thank you so much for being part of Register Radio. I'm sure we'll talk to you once we hear what the ruling is.
I look forward to it.
When we return, have you heard about the new movie, The Young Messiah? We'll talk with its director next. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
Imagine if you could help inspire millions of Catholics around the globe by providing a life-changing perspective on the events of the world. Imagine if you could bring faithful Catholic journalism to clergy, seminarians, and religious. Imagine if you could be a part of continuing Mother Angelica's dream of providing faithful Catholic news true to the teachings of the Church. You can do all this and more by donating to the National Catholic Register. The Register needs your help to continue our mission and close the funding gap we now face. You can make the difference with a donation, large or small. Go to ncregister.com/donate or mail your donation to the National Catholic Register at P.O. Box 100699, Irondale, Alabama 35210.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DiMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Cyrus Narasta, has worked in the motion picture and television business for over 25 years as a writer, producer, and director. He has won 2 Penn Awards, the Orson Welles Award, a Freedom of Expression Award, and many more. He's here today to talk about his newest movie, The Young Messiah.
Thank you very much for being with us, Cyrus. It's great to talk to you about this new film, which comes out on March 11th nationwide. I appreciate having you on today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, Young Messiah, as the title gives away, is about the life of Jesus as a young boy. He's 7 years old in the film. I haven't seen the film yet, so I look forward to it. But, you know, the life of Jesus is not fully detailed in the Bible. So what were the sources for your story in creating this film?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, yes, you're telling the story of the young Messiah during the lost years. Somebody said, I think it was one of our producers, Chris Columbus, said, this is the greatest story never told.
Sure.
So what we have is a novel based on a book by Anne Rice, the author. It was written over 10 years ago. She had her sources, but then we had to basically go over those and, in the writing of the script, show the script to theologians, biblical scholars, pastors, people that we knew, and see if there were any red flags that came up. Because what we wanted to do more than anything else was portray a young Jesus who was consistent with Jesus as he's revealed in the Bible.
Sure.
And that was very important to us to do it with some measure of reverence and respect. We didn't want to offend anyone. What we're trying to do here really is sort of, I guess, reintroduce oneself to Jesus in a way at a different time in his life, where perhaps as a child he's more relatable, more accessible than
sure.
a vision on the cross.
That's a very great point. In fact, one of the things I wanted to ask you is what about this early time in his life do you want people to walk away thinking about, and perhaps that what about this life would help us in our own faith?
Like I just said, you know, there's something about a child. You know how we sort of will lean down and look at a child in the eye and want to connect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like we kind of melt around children. We want to embrace them and talk to them and find out what's in their head. Well, here we've got the child, Jesus, fully divine, fully human. And as the human child, Jesus, at age 7, he's starting to ask a lot of questions. Age 7 is the dawn of reason in all children. It's where they have a concept of death, but they also start to ask questions, like almost for that age anyway, philosophical type questions about the world and about who they are. And this child is no different. And in this story, we kind of get a chance to relate to this child and to this brilliant, very special child. And we see him performing acts of compassion and kindness. We see him show love. We see him part of a family. We see him playing with other children. We see a human Jesus. And I've watched children watch this movie in advanced screenings, and they're enthralled by that idea.
Yeah.
There is this image that children see when they see this image of a man sort of on the cross, nailed to the cross, with a crown of thorns. It's scary.
Sure.
There's just something about it, you know. And we know about the Savior, and we know about his sacrifice, but do we know his heart? Can we really connect to him on a human level? And I think by portraying him as a child, it allows us to do that.
Now, there's a difficulty in talking about the young Jesus as he discovers who he is, which is so much a part of this movie. I mean, some believers struggle with that idea that Jesus, you know, didn't fully understand who he was. How does the movie deal with that very sensitive question that some viewers
sure.
might find confusing?
You know, we had a number of theologians and biblical scholars that we consulted with, as I told you. They basically told us that Jesus veiled his divinity in accordance with the Father's will to experience what it was like to be human. So it's part of a theological sort of exercise or question that's probably more complicated.
Sure.
Than I really wanted to get into. So what I did was I just sort of accepted that on face value, that it is part of Jesus' journey here, according to the Father, that as the Son of God, he connects with us, you know, so he subjects himself to physical, intellectual, social, and spiritual growth. He voluntarily puts himself in the position of needing to kind of assimilate as a man and assimilate knowledge, you know, and take in the world as a man.
Yeah, that's very well said. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Cyrus Narasthith, who is the director of Young Messiah. We're talking about this film that's going to debut on March 10th across the United States. And as we talk about this film, you know, I'm thinking that you wrote this with your wife, which must have been a unique experience. And I'm just wondering, what drew the two of you to collaborate and to work on this particular film?
Well, you know, we've worked on films together before. My previous film, The Stoning of Soraya M., we worked on together. But this is got an interesting history to it, because when the book originally came out over 10 years ago, Betsy just sort of picked it up and read it. And I remember talking to me about it. I thought, boy, that sounds like an amazing idea for a story. Mm-hmm. The thought that we would be given the opportunity to make this into a film was the furthest thing from our mind at the time, because it just didn't seem possible. When we made Stoning of Soraya M., Anne Rice actually wrote a review of it, a rave review, and through a series of happy coincidences and circumstances, we were able to get in a position to adapt her book into a movie. And that was an honor and a privilege. I think Anne wrote a beautiful book, and we just didn't want to mess it up. Now, but along with that, adapting any novel to the screen has huge challenges and risks, especially a story like this, because of some of the theological things that you've already brought up, where there were things in the book that we felt in the movie we couldn't necessarily do the way they were in the book. Mm-hmm. There are also just issues of dramatic narrative that a movie is generally more plotted. It's external. The book was internal, basically the first-person voice of young Jesus. So there were a lot of challenges in adapting it, but I think we've been very faithful to her novel without being literal to it.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned to Steve Gradonis, who is the Register's film critic, you know, the 5 years of struggle over trying to get this project off the ground. And in that conversation with Stephen, you referenced some little miracles that made the film possible. And you said, I do believe in angels after this film was made. You know, it makes me think, are there other memorable moments in the actual filming and the creation of this film that our audience would find interesting?
Well, you know, you can't make a movie by yourself. I mean, I don't even think Steven Spielberg could make a movie by himself. And, you know, we had a jump start on this in 2013. We were going to go, and we were there. We were in Italy, building sets, costumes, casting, spending money. And we had to shut down because one of the financial people that was involved just didn't do his job. And, you know, it was like a death. It was like a funeral. When a movie shuts down like that, you're usually done. It's over. And by the way, we had spent $3 million. So now mm-hmm. we're trying to reimagine and resurrect this movie being $3 million in the hole. And it's hard enough to get to a movie made when you're even.
Right, sure.
You're starting at zero. Or even when you actually, I've been in situations where we've had some money where somebody has partially financed the movie and still can't get it. Get the completion fund. So, but it's funny, that shutdown forced us to re-look at the script, because we knew in order to get the movie back up, we'd have to make it for probably half the budget we'd originally intended. We rewrote the script. It was much leaner, much tighter. Everybody thought it was a better script. Also, if we'd shot the movie when we originally intended to shoot it, we would have had 3 out of 4 days of rain, which would have crippled us. Mm. When we finally did shoot the movie, when we only had 1 day of rain. The other thing is, there's something kind of magical that happened with young Adam Graves Neal, who's the young actor who plays Jesus. And that is, between the time when I originally saw him to about a year and 9 months later, when we actually finally made the film, he had matured. Hmm. Luckily, physically, he didn't grow too much.
He didn't grow. That could have harmed you.
Right. But he mentally, intellectually, emotionally had matured to the point where I really believe he'd come to understand what the movie was about and who he was playing and what the scenes were about and what the moments were. Do you know what I mean? It's like an actor can sort of see his way into each situation, dramatic situation they're put in, and understand the dramatic context, understand the script, understand what the other actor is saying to them. That's a whole different performance.
Right, and a child's life, a couple of years, makes a big difference. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense and would certainly be an unseen blessing. So, you know, there's one other question that I've got to ask before we end this interview, and that is, so you can't talk about the young Messiah without talking about his parents, of course. So this film is about Jesus, but it's also about Mary and Joseph. So what does the film tell us about his parents?
You see your way into the Holy Family in this movie like you've never seen in any movie. Because not only is Jesus portrayed as an icon in most movies, usually, but Mary is also, and furthermore, Joseph is usually just wallpaper. He's just kind of hanging in the back with the donkeys.
Yeah.
So, you know, I felt like, boy, we get to really see what they're like. We get to see how the family interacts. We get to see the incredible burden of these parents who not only love and want to care for their child, but, oh, by the way, he's the Son of God. So to know that their child has this incredible destiny, but they're not, they don't really know any of the details. They have this incredible burden of keeping a secret. You know, they need to let him just be a regular child, have a normal childhood, while also knowing he's the Son of God, he's the people's Messiah, and the responsibility of protecting him when you know that others are out to kill him. What's interesting about it is also parents can see that Joseph and Mary had burdens of their own that parents can connect to now. Joseph and Mary living in a time of great chaos, threat, and danger, and trying to navigate their way through that and raise their children in a safe family home where they can be educated and you know, grow up. We see them love and support each other in this movie. You see intimate scenes between Joseph and Mary. I'm talking about intimate emotional scenes. I'm not talking about anything else. You see them walk through life's trials and challenges together, you know. You see him care for extended family, for cousins.
You know, in today's day and age, we need such a witness of family life. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how the movie portrays the family, because, gosh, we need it. And what better family to emulate our lives on than the Holy Family. Cyrus, thank you so much for being with us today. I really do look forward to this movie.
Thanks, Jeanette. It's been great being with you. Wonderful questions.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this time on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.